Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. HPV, the human papilloma virus, is the most commonly sexually transmitted disease in America. The more partners, the greater your chance of getting it. And it can be a killer, especially for women, when it leads to cervical cancer. Now, federal health experts have recommended that all 11 to 12-year-old American girls get a newly approved vaccine that blocks most types of the virus and the cancer that can follow. And big decisions are pending for states that will decide whether to make it mandatory, and for families weighing a breakthrough with big implications for their young daughters' long-term health and sex lives. Up next on Point, sex, health, daughters, and decisions on a breakthrough new vaccine. In a moment, we'll hear from one of the members of the HPV Working Group, the chair for the Centers for Disease Control. On June 29th, her committee recommended that all 11- and 12-year-old girls be given the newly approved vaccine. But first, joining me from Los Angeles is Jane Allen, a health and medical writer who reports on women's health issues for Los Angeles Magazine and Oprah's O Magazine. Jane Allen, thanks for being with us.
Oh, Tom, it's a pleasure to be with you again.
This is being received as very big news, a vaccine in a kind of new area where we're not accustomed to thinking about vaccines. To remind us first about human papillomavirus, HPV. What is it, how widespread, and its connection to cervical cancer, Jane?
Something that you may have noticed recently, Tom, is that HPV awareness has been part of a public awareness campaign that was run by the maker of this new vaccine. If you were watching TV, you'd see some women walk around saying, "Oh my God, cancer caused by a virus? I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. I want to tell every woman that I know." Indeed, HPV, or human papillomavirus, is associated with many infections, but there are about 40 or more types of HPV that are associated with genital infections. HPV is something that is spread by skin contact, and it is the number one cause of cervical cancer. That does mean that cervical cancer is a largely preventable disease. Now, going back to HPV and what it is and what it does, it's a very, very common STD, or sexually transmitted disease. In fact, it's the most common right now in the United States. It is something that people get concerned about as soon as a young woman becomes sexually active, because within about 4 years of starting to have sex, about 50% of young women will start to show signs or perhaps be infected with HPV. The other thing we have to understand is that HPV is not all equivalent. There are some strains of it that may cause genital warts, which are somewhat nasty but can be eliminated. Mm. And then there are some strains that cause cancer. And those need to be distinguished. Part of the good news about the new vaccine is that it targets both. Going back to the risks, it's basically a sexually transmitted disease that starts with skin-to-skin contact.
Does that mean sexual intercourse or something less?
Actually, it can be transmitted by intercourse, and it can also be transmitted by oral sex.
Okay.
So that's something that people need to think about. It also can be transmitted by anal sex. Excuse me. So this is a risk for women. It's a risk for men. And although cervical cancer is the problem that we talk about the most, because cervical cancer is the second most common cancer in women around the world, in the U.S., we have about 9,700 cases of cervical cancer a year. 4,000 of those women die. But it also can, in men, produce anal and penile cancers, and in women, it can also create some cancers of the vagina and other, genital areas. So it's something to think about in a somewhat broader context, although, as I said, cervical cancer is the big concern.
Now, the new vaccine is being described as for women. Does it not work for males? Is there something coming on that score? And B, how does this work, and why 11- and 12-year-old girls for the vaccination?
First of all, the reason that we're talking about giving it to women is because that is the population in whom the vaccine has been tested. Right now, there is continuing work being done with young men, and then they will start to be looking at women over the age of 26. The reason that people want to get to women when they're young and they're still in girlhood is that they want to get to them before they've ever been exposed to the virus. If you inoculate somebody or vaccinate someone before exposure, this vaccine has been shown to prevent 100% of infections with two strains of HPV, 16 and 18, which are associated with cervical cancer, and strains number 6 and strain 11, which are associated with genital or venereal warts.
So you knock out most, but not all, of the risk.
You knock out most of the risk. Now, Tom, something very, very interesting came out yesterday. A new study came out from researchers at McGill up in Canada showing that the risk for developing precancerous changes, or the tissue changes that come before full-blown cervical cancer, are associated with being infected with multiple types of HPV. And in that study, they found that the new vaccine, the Gardasil vaccine that just came from Merck, does not protect against a strain called HPV 58. And this study found that that particular strain is even more cancer-causing when it's found in the presence of other strains than ever believed before.
So it's not perfect, but it's more protection than women have ever had if they get the vaccination.
If they get it in time. Now, if you've already been exposed to some of the strains, the vaccine will protect you from the others among the four strains it's effective against, so you can get some partial protection.
We see, I'm reading here statistics, 26% of young American women have sex before age, by age 15. So that's why I guess public health authorities are looking younger, 11 and 12. They want to be sure to get them before they hit that window.
That's exactly what it is. It's get them before they even start to have sex, before they even start to have oral sex. And if you think about the public health problem in young girls, many of them may not be having sexual intercourse or, you know, traditional sex, but some of them are having oral sex. And if you are sexually active at an early age and you have an older boyfriend who is infected, who is having sexual activity with another woman, he could pass the virus on to you.
Some influential conservative religious groups, and we'll hear from them, but they've welcomed this but said it must not be mandated. It must be the parents' choice. What's the dynamic here? They haven't put the kibosh on this.
I think there's a very interesting question here about when do parents become aware of their children's sexual activity and how much control do they want to have over the course of disease. I think that parents easily accept vaccination against many other transmissible diseases, although there are parents who choose not to vaccinate. But in this case, it does raise enormous moral questions. We live in a country that is somewhat puritanical and talks about sex only in the context of marriage. But the reality is that many, many people have sex earlier in life, and they are at risk. And the question becomes, do you stick your head in the sand, or do you accept that this is going on earlier? And then second, do you voluntarily take your child to the doctor for a series of inoculations that cost $360? If you are poor, this will be covered. There's a particular vaccine program for children that will cover it. But it's a big step, and I think psychologically for parents, it's an enormous step. You know, moms and dads don't want to think about preteens as sexual creatures yet.
So a lot of big decisions here about who's going to get it, who's going to pay for it, and individual families working out their own decisions, as you say, Jane, perhaps before parents are really ready to think about these issues in such explicit terms. Jane Allen, it's always terrific talking with you. We're very grateful for your briefing. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Happy to be here, Tom. Thank you.
Jane Allen writes on health issues for Los Angeles Magazine and Oprah's O Magazine. I'm joined now from Portland, Oregon by Janet Gilsdorf. She's chair of the HPV Working Group for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Advisory's Committee on Immunization Practices. She's a professor of pediatrics and communicable diseases at the University of Michigan. Janet Gilsdorf, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
It's a big recommendation, $360 immunization vaccine. That's very expensive. For all 11- and 12-year-old girls, you were in on the consideration of this. What brought your group to this large recommendation?
Tom, the HPV working group spent over 2 years reviewing considerable amount of scientific data about the virus, about the vaccine, about the disease. And our mission was to develop guidelines for the CDC for how this vaccine should be used. We The vaccine is licensed for girls between ages 9 and women ages 26.
So that means it's effective. If you get it between 9 and 26, if you're not already infected, it would work any time during that span?
Yes. The vaccine was licensed by the FDA as being safe and effective in girls ages 9 through women ages 26.
Okay.
Those are the age groups that were studied in the vaccine trials.
Mm-hmm. But 11 and 12 is the optimum age, and you're saying for everybody. Did you make a recommendation about whether or not this should be mandatory? Of course, we do have mandatory vaccinations in this country. What about this one?
Mandatory vaccine laws are the purview of the states. The federal government does not have the jurisdiction to make mandatory vaccine laws, or at least they've never exercised that priority. So our recommendations serve as guidelines. They're used by policymakers, by public health officials, by primary care physicians, but we do not make mandatory recommendations.
So each state is going to have to decide, and if they don't go mandatory, then it's each family. For now, it's each family. Has this already begun, Janet Gilstrap? Are there families who are deciding? Are there 11- and 12-year-old girls who are already being immunized with the new HPV vaccine?
The vaccine was licensed on June 8th, and very shortly after that, the company began shipping the vaccine to its distributors. So it is just now becoming available in health clinics and in physicians' offices. So I think we can expect that it will start to be given. We don't anticipate that it will be widely given immediately because there's a lot of education, a lot of thinking that needs to happen.
We're joined right now from Colorado Springs, Colorado, by Linda Klepacki. She is analyst for sexual health for Focus on the Family, a conservative Christian group based there in Colorado Springs. She's a registered nurse with a background in public health. Linda, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
We want to understand how you and your group are looking at this. I see your colleague there, Bridget Mayer, quoted in the New Scientist magazine saying that this is potentially harmful because people may see it as a license to engage in premarital sex. Are you welcoming this new vaccine? Are you pushing back? What's your position?
Tom, Bridget is a colleague, but she does not represent Focus on the Family. Focus on the Family has always supported the widespread availability of this vaccine. We see it as a very significant scientific breakthrough, but we also support the parents' right to decide whether they will vaccinate their minor children.
So that would leave it in the hands of each family. Are you making a recommendation to families about whether or not they ought to get it for their daughters?
No, actually, we're not, Tom. We have, I think, come up with a very balanced statement about this vaccine. We have talked to parents through a written word and through our radio program about reasons why you might want to vaccinate your daughters. We also understand that parents often choose not to vaccinate their children. And since this is not an infection that leads to a disease that they will catch by sitting in the classroom, we feel that it's a particular concern that parents' rights be uplifted.
Linda, Focus on the Family is a very strong supporter of premarital abstinence. So if a family gets the vaccination for their daughter, do you see that as a kind of a cop-out or surrender on the abstinence front? If you're committed to abstinence, in your view, do you still need this vaccination?
You know, we've never stated that, Tom. There are instances why you might want to vaccinate, even if your daughter does choose to remain sexually abstinent until marriage. They may marry a spouse who has been sexually active. They may marry a spouse who does not know their sexually transmitted infection history, don't know currently if they're infected with a sexually transmitted infection. There are instances of date rape and rape and sexual assault where girls have no choice whether they become sexually active or not. And so we have put those within our statement. I really believe we have a very balanced statement for parents to think through multiple issues and come to their best decision for their own family of whether they'll vaccinate their girls.
Janet Gilstrap, do you personally have a position, an opinion on whether or not this ought to be mandatory? You're a professor of communicable diseases. What do you think is preferable, leave it up to the family or have the state say everybody gets it?
I think the family is a very important social institution for their children, and family values and family traditions are key. I also think that this vaccine will be very effective in protecting young women against cervical cancer. So I think it's a complicated, important issue. Families need to discuss this. They need to provide their daughters and themselves with information about how best to protect themselves against this infection. I think that the HPV vaccine is an important way in which they can be protected.
So a real boost for women's health here and a real important family conversation. We have lots of listeners who have questions and comments. I want to bring them in. Barbara's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi. I never thought I'd agree with focus on the family, but...
But here you are.
Yeah, I would certainly get my daughter vaccinated, even though she promised when she was 8 years old that she'd be a virgin when she got married.
Easy promise at eight, a little tougher later.
Right. But I think, I mean, I certainly will get her vaccinated to protect her from her husband or any legitimate sexual partner she ever has. I think there's nothing wrong with having it mandatory with an opt-out provision so that people who really care will... They can not get their kids vaccinated, but for all the people who really don't think about it too much, I think it should be maybe not mandatory, but opt out rather than opt in.
Linda Klopecki, how about that? What about mandatory with an opt out? Would that, as a public health matter, would that be more effective in suppressing the human papillomavirus?
Well, we do have opt-out, even if it becomes mandatory. We have, in all 50 states, we have medical exemptions for any vaccine. In 48 states, we have religious exemptions. And in 20 states, we have not only religious exemptions, but also philosophical exemptions.
But you're not supporting that mandatory unless opt-out path. Why not?
Because it's not a necessary vaccine for somebody who is attending public school. If you, for instance, if you're sitting in the classroom and somebody has chicken pox or somebody has the flu, a type
or
of
measles.
Flu that you could get, or measles, you can contract that through secretions, through somebody coughing, somebody touching you who hasn't washed their hands. There's all different ways to communicate it. You cannot contract human papillomavirus by sitting in a classroom, or at least we hope you're not going to, because that means you are engaging in sexual behaviors. And so having this vaccine available, having it already, my understanding is, and perhaps Dr. Gilsdorf can talk more about this, that already the federal monies have been released to allow people who can't afford the vaccine to pay for it. I also understand that there's multiple insurance companies that have already given the green light to cover these immunizations. And so there's no reason to vaccinate against a purely sexually transmitted disease in a mandated form. It is the parents' right to choose for their minor children.
Janet Gilsdorf, describe for us what the rollout of this is going to be like. How is this first going to come into most families' lives? Will it be through their insurer, schools, something from the government, from a poverty program? How's it going to roll out?
Well, with the recommendations that the ACIP, or the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, has developed, this vaccine now is being considered for financing through insurance companies. I think we can expect some firm information about that over the next several months. As Linda Klopecki just mentioned, the Vaccines for Children program has provided funding for this vaccine.
This is for low-income families, low-income children.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And it covers about 40% of U.S. children between ages 0 and 18 years.
Does that mean they'll start getting it, and when?
Children who are covered by the VFC program get their vaccines either through public health clinics or through their primary care physicians. So as soon as the clinic or the physician's office obtains the vaccine, the funding is there to support the delivery of the vaccine.
Will the family have to ask for it, or will they be automatically presented with the option?
I'm sure that will vary from clinic to clinic and physician office to physician office. We hope that both public health clinics and physicians' offices will encourage their patients and their families to consider this vaccine and be prepared to answer their questions.
Let me get a call from Kevin in Amherst, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a single parent. I raised my daughter from the age of 2.5 until she went off on her own at 18.
Yeah.
If this vaccine had been available when my daughter was going through puberty, I certainly would have gotten it for her, and I would have talked to her about why she was getting it.
Would you have worried about the message that it was giving her, might give her, or would you have celebrated, her immunization against a real threat here?
I would have celebrated the immunization, and I don't see a threat of promiscuity through an inoculation. It's great boon is protection against a disease. It is not a sign that says, here I am, I'm available.
And what about mandatory vaccination? Kevin, you would have done it for your daughter, might still encourage her to do it. What about for everybody, mandatory?
No.
Why not?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
I would have it available. I would have a nationwide education program, but it is always ultimately up to the parent. It's the parent's choice whether, it doesn't matter what their grounds are for accepting it or not, but I can't see the state ever saying, we're going to do this whether you want it or not.
Mm. Kevin, thanks very much for your call. I want to welcome one more voice into our conversation. From New York, we're joined by Katha Pollitt. She's a columnist for The Nation magazine, author of the book Virginity or Death and Other Social and Political Issues of Our Time. Katha Pollitt, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
You've written a lot about sexuality, female sexuality, social constraints thereon. What's your response to this new vaccination and the debate over how it ought to be distributed, about how these decisions ought to be made and who ought to get it, Katha?
I think this vaccine is a wonderful, wonderful development. I mean, a vaccine against cancer, can you believe it? It's great. I'm interested in the way this discussion has gone around the word mandatory. Mandatory always sounds like bad. It sounds like, oh, the government's going to make you do something. But then people say, no, we want the parents to decide. But mandatory lets the parents decide, as Linda from Focus on the Family said.
Because in most states they can opt out if they don't want something.
Absolutely. In every state they can opt out if they don't want something. So really it's not about the big bad government making parents give their child a vaccine. I mean, if you don't want to have your child vaccinated against tetanus because you think it will encourage your child to take off her shoes and run around on rusty nails, you can do that. I mean, maybe you shouldn't be able to do that, but you can. That's the law.
So what's the argument for automatic vaccination here unless there's an opt-out, Katha, instead of each family deciding positively on its own?
Well, I'm not, a huge expert on this, but it's my understanding that what mandatory means is that you would have to opt out, that the government would have to make this vaccine available to you, and it wouldn't be at whatever your income level, it wouldn't be that you have to take the initiative, find out about the vaccine, go to the doctor, hope that your doctor has it. There are so many gaps in healthcare coverage in this country, and vaccination is a big success. And I would think that if you can vaccinate a child against a sexually transmitted disease and the cancer it causes down the road, this is just tremendously wonderful. Another point is that, boys also get HPV.
Mm-hmm.
Your first guest pointed out, and it has all kinds of complicated effects in them, although not
sure.
Quite so dramatic, mm-hmm. And also it's not as easily diagnosed as in women. So ideally, down the road, we need to think about vaccinating boys too. Now, if the vaccine isn't mandatory, if it's just something the parent has to go, take all the initiative about and find out about and figure out how to pay for it, and $360 is a lot of money.
Yes, it is.
And that's not counting the money you pay the doctor for the privilege of getting the vaccination,
mm-hmm.
Right? And you have to go back three times over the course of a year, which for a lot of parents is a big hassle.
It's a heavy round, yep.
Exactly. I just wonder if we're ever going to get that herd immunity that is one of the great things about public health measures. You need to have a lot of people vaccinated.
To get everybody in the boat to really kind of put a roadblock down here. I want to hear from our listeners. Mary Ann's calling from Greenwich, Connecticut. Hi, Mary Ann. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
So I am fighting cervix cancer. I have a high-risk human papillomavirus, a mom of a 3-year-old daughter, and the HPV virus, after radiation and chemotherapy, is still acting up and causing more damage again. So I'm a big promoter of having the vaccination mandated.
So this could have saved you a terrible amount of trouble in your life. Is it then a no-brainer that you'll get this for your daughter when she turns 11 or 12?
It is a no-brainer, and I just want to add this point. I was raised by a wonderful conservative Catholic family, and we did not promote, you know, sexual promiscuity. Mm-hmm. I had a handful of partners, and I'm stunned that I have this virus. I don't know how I got it or by who, because I had so few partners,
mm-hmm.
and now my life is threatened, and it's terrible. And this virus, despite my chemotherapy and radiation, it appears it is active. The tests have come back. It is still active, and it can bring back my cancer.
So why mandatory then, Marianne? Why not still? I mean, parents understand this. It's not that people don't know about it. Why not let families decide?
Because in my situation, my family knew that I was not sleeping around, if I could put it that
mm-hmm.
way. I wouldn't have gotten it. And getting it by this slight chance of whoever passed it to me, it's so you never think it will happen to you, and here I am, it's happened to me. So you don't think you're ever going to get it because of your moral values, because of the way you're raised,
right.
because of the people you choose to be with, but lo and behold, one of these partners got it from someone and innocently passed it to me.
And gave it to you, and you're still struggling with it, and we wish you good luck in that fight, Marianne, and thanks for your call. Linda Klepecki, how about it? Here's a caller. She's got mm-hmm. cervical cancer, and she says, you know, I'm not sure my family would have chosen this for me. She says, make it mandatory to make sure that future females like her won't be left vulnerable.
You know, we never want to see anybody suffering from sexually transmitted infections, especially something like cervical cancer that is a lifelong suffering. We support primary prevention. Primary health prevention means preventing the behaviors in the first place. So we do support abstinence until marriage and fidelity in marriage. We also support parents teaching their children about sexuality from the time that they're toddlers, from the time they start asking questions. Dr. Dobson has taught for years.
This is James Dobson, the head of Focus on the Family, yes?
That's correct, that we really should be wrapping up our discussions about sexuality with our children by the time they hit puberty.
Kathy's calling right now from Marlborough, Massachusetts. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if it's possible to know a little bit more about the potential side effects of this or potential complications. I had a good friend who took a mandatory flu shot with the military. He's in the Navy, and he contracted a very rare disease called ADEM, and he's paralyzed now from the waist down.
So what about potential side effects? With any vaccination, people always think about that. I'm glad you raised it, Kathy. Janet, how about it? How much do we know about potential side effects or downsides of this vaccine?
Over 11,000 women and a few men received this vaccine during the clinical trial. So there's a wide experience with the HPV vaccine. By far and away, the most common complications were local, such as pain at the injection site, swelling of the arm, or redness of the arm. Only 1-2% of these reactions were considered severe. So it's a very safe vaccine. Less than 1% of recipients had a fever over 102, which was the same as the placebo group. There were no vaccine-associated deaths. It is true that unexpected complications do occur rarely from all vaccines.
But compared to, let's say, polio or diphtheria, measles, vaccines required in all 50 states, equally safe as far as it's known?
As far as we know, again, those vaccines have been used in millions of people, so we have much more information about them. I think it's also important to realize that this is not a live virus vaccine. This vaccine is composed of a purified protein. Also, there are no preservatives in this vaccine, no thimerosal, for example.
So a fairly good bill of health for it right there. The thumbs up, and clearly your group has recommended it, so you've got confidence in it. You hear the caution, but that's a pretty good signal. Alex is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think, Alex? What do you know?
Well, as far as in our society, our avoidance of discussing sexuality in teens, I think, tends to lend the idea that sexual diseases are only things dirty people are going to get, or they're so far away from being an invincible teenager that involving kids in the vaccination process, I say kids, but young teens, makes it real for them. It gives the parents an opportunity to open a discussion on what consequences could be of sexual activity at a young age, and it might actually promote abstinence rather than promiscuity in kids.
So you're saying sitting down with that 11- or 12-year-old daughter might be a real opportunity here to talk about the realities of sexual health.
A huge opportunity. And for her at that young age to have to already think about, wow, I mean, so I could catch something? You're taking me to get inoculated for, you know, this virus. You know, maybe I should really consider consequences.
Katha Pollitt, how do you respond? Is this a window of opportunity for good conversations about a healthy sexual life?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, as your first guest pointed out, it's not as if this vaccine means you will never get a sexually transmitted disease. It means you won't get cancer when you are an adult person. You know, I want to get back to the caller that that shared the story of her.
This is Marianne in Greenwich, who was raised in a conservative family now has cervical cancer.
What an amazing story. And, you know, Focus on the Family's Linda's response to that was, well, she made some poor choices. Well, how high should the price be for having premarital sex? I mean, honestly, you know, there are not too many people who are virgins when they marry and who marry another virgin and stay faithful forever. I'm sorry. And, you know, in the states that are the most Bible Belt oriented, like Oklahoma, what happens is that there's so much pressure on, you know, kids marrying before sex. They marry too young, and Oklahoma has an astronomical divorce rate. So, you know, the idea that you can just sort of put people in a box and keep them safe, but if they get out of the box, then they're on their own. I don't think that this is a model for compassion or, you know, public health or anything good. Do you think some woman is going to go back to her mom and dad when she's 50 and she has cervical cancer and say, oh, thanks? Thanks, parents. You know?
Linda Klepecki, what do you make of that?
Yes, I'd like to speak to that.
Please.
The one statement that Katha just made, I think, is important to clarify the truth on, is that she said that this vaccine is going to eliminate cervical cancer, eliminate the suffering. It will cover 70% of cervical cancer, and we have to make sure that everybody knows that because they get this vaccine doesn't mean they have 100% immunity from cervical cancer, from those strains of HPV that cause cervical cancer.
Let me just confirm
that
number, Janet. You're on the panel. Is that correct, Janet? It's 70% of the risk is diminished here, Janet?
Well, actually, it's a little more complicated than that. The vaccine covers 70% of the cancer types of HPV vaccine. Of course, we don't know the full value of this vaccine, but models have suggested that if an 11 or 12-year-old girl receives this vaccine, that her lifetime risk of cervical cancer will be decreased between 20 and 66%. And that's a very wide range. The reason for that is we know the efficacy of the vaccine during the trials, but sometimes real-life situation shows different types of efficacy. We also do not know the duration of protection of this vaccine. The longest individuals have been followed for 4.5 years, and they remain protected. But we don't know if the vaccine will provide lifelong protection.
So, Linda, there to your point, it's not blanket protection here, and you cite that why?
I cite that why, because Katha made the statement that this will protect people from, or women from, cervical cancer for their lifetime. And Dr. Gilsdorf just clarified that neither one of those statements is true. Also, in reaction to Katha's question about, well, how high of a price do we have to pay for having sex outside of marriage, for heaven's sakes? There's a very high price for having sex out of marriage. It's not just a physical price, but it's also emotional and mental. And for many people, it's a spiritual price. So having sex outside of marriage does have consequences. And the one call-in person who said, you know, maybe this is a great opportunity for parents to talk to kids. This is one of the best opportunities for parents to talk to their kids and talk to them about those consequences, and that whether they decide to vaccinate or not, there are real health, mental, emotional consequences for having sex outside of marriage.
We've got a lot of listeners who want to talk about this. Steve's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to comment that this, you know, would be a great thing, I would think, for any parent. Your first priority as a parent is to protect your child, and anything you can immunize or decrease the chance of them getting later in life, you know, especially with the cost of medical care, would be a good thing. I don't think that it would promote promiscuity at all, because that's going to boil down to their upbringing and their own moral values, not whether or not they got a shot that decreased their chance of getting cancer.
So you see it as, in the first instance, just another way of protecting them, and you say, yes, indeed, you do it. Let's get a call from Nashville. Jim's on the line. Hi, Jim. What do you think?
Hello. My understanding of some of the objection is that by discussing it with the child, somehow there's some implied permission or condemnation of sexual promiscuity. I guess my comment is, why do you necessarily need to go into that much detail about it? Why not couch it as a vaccine against, or to protect you from exposure to cancer?
And leave it at that.
And how many 11 or 12-year-old girls are going to ask that much about the mechanics? I mean, they're not going to ask about a mumps vaccine or a tetanus shot.
Right.
Why would they necessarily ask about this?
That's a great question. Janet Gilsdorf, have you made any recommendations along with this about how to present this? What's your opinion? Just go in and say, hey, sweetie, we've got a vaccination for you here, or sit down and talk it all out?
Well, we have not made specific recommendations about how to discuss this vaccine with the young people or with their families. But we certainly know that girls at 11 and 12 years of age are not all alike. And some girls are much more mature than other girls. And we would recommend age-appropriate discussions. We would want their questions to be answered. We would want language to be used that they can understand and can relate to. And the most important message we would want them to get is that we love you. We want to protect you from things that will hurt you.
Katha Pollitt, Linda Klepecki has a kind of counter implication here, that in suggesting that there's blanket protection, there's also a risk to women's lives here. What do you think about the messaging that ought to go along with the vaccination?
No, I think my point, I think she misunderstood what I said. What I said was that no matter how well the vaccine protects you against what it protects you against, there are still lots of other sexually transmitted diseases. There's lots of, there's lots of other strains of the human papillomavirus. It's not like you're getting a sort of get-out-of-jail-free card with this vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I just find this obsession with keeping young people away from sex, as opposed to helping them deal responsibly with their sexual desires and their sexual choices, which might not be abstinence. I find that so disturbing. I find it's completely unrealistic. Unless you're going to have people married off when they're 14, like in Afghanistan.
And this is kind of you're sort of mocking this in your book title, Virginity or Death. You're saying that's the choice being offered.
I do. I think so. I think that, you know, the focus on the family seems willing to say, if the parents want their child to risk a fatal illness rather, you know, if they have sex, and that sex could be rape, it could be coercive, it could be all kinds of things, fine, so be it. I find that so disturbing.
But Linda says that there are bigger messages here as well, spiritual messages that they want to convey to everyone, certainly
fine.
To their flock.
Okay, convey a spiritual message, but we're not talking about a spiritual message on this show. We're talking about a physical message. That's something else. We're talking about the chances of getting a very, very serious disease years down the road after you have made whatever, quote, mistake, unquote, we're talking about here.
Linda, I'm sure you've got another perspective on that, but I want to hear from our listeners as well. Maggie's calling from Orleans, Massachusetts. Hi, Maggie. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you this morning?
Very well.
First off, I must state that I think looking at it from the perspective of women being more promiscuous if they get this vaccine is absolutely ridiculous. That's my opinion. But if we are going to talk about promiscuity, I have yet to hear where the other half of this promiscuity, the men, the boys that are involved, have a responsibility in this. All I hear is my responsibility as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the high points for me based on everything I've heard so far.
Yeah. Let us pick up exactly that. And if I may, before we go to it, I've got a male calling in on just that vein from San Diego, California. Mike's calling. And Mike, you may want to speak to this. What's your comment or question, Mike?
Yes, good morning. I think that in the realm of the college arena, it's very bizarre that students in college are very promiscuous and it's a part of the social sphere, but it's not discussed. And even if someone does have an STD, it's considered absolutely taboo.
And I've got a note here saying you think you may have it.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, it could be on my genitals, but I'm not certain. And I'm afraid to perhaps seek treatment, or what would be the consequences of such a thing? For example, if I were to seek treatment, I might hypothetically have to withdraw from sexual activity. Well, I'm not really sure what's involved with that, but I don't believe that males are aware or even discuss it in their social lives, particularly in college.
And what about your responsibility? Maggie asks about it. What about the boys, she says? Do you feel a responsibility if there's some question to be upfront about this, or you're saying that's impossible in the social setting of college?
Well, in the social setting of college, it's impossible. Well, not really impossible. It's just it's a difficult burden for men to step up to the plate and admit that they have an STD, because it's easier for men to displace the blame and responsibility of STDs on females instead of take it responsibility for themselves.
Yeah, we hear that, Mike, and we wish you good luck. Janet, what about a male version of this vaccine? Is it out there? Is it on the way?
The vaccine was studied in some males, but those trials are not complete. So they're ongoing, and we expect that the drug company will present the male version of the vaccine to the FDA in the next couple years.
It's coming. And why $360? That's so much more than other vaccines. Why?
Well, pricing of vaccines and other pharmaceuticals is a very complicated issue. This was the price that Merck assigned to the vaccine. This is the list price.
We're going to have to understand that on another day. Do you have a daughter? Would you recommend this for your own daughter, Janet?
I do not have a daughter. I have two sons. And if I had a daughter, I would absolutely have her vaccinated. I have suggested my daughter-in-law receive this vaccine.
How old is she?
She is just at the top end of the recommended age.
Up by 26. So even there, you say yes. Go for it. Linda Klepecki, we've just got a few seconds here. How do you tell an 11-year-old girl what you're up to here, or do you?
Tom, we have several resources on one of our websites, focusonsocialissues.org, for parents to actually understand the vaccine more, to understand human papillomavirus more, and actual language to talk to their 11 or 12-year-old daughter with. So we really encourage people to go to that website and to have discussions from the time they start asking questions in toddlerhood. Sexuality is a normal part of our humanhood. We need to be discussing it with our children.
And Katha Pollitt, in a word, what do you anticipate? Look, 10, 20 years down the road, do you think most females will get this vaccine?
I think that will depend on price, accessibility, publicity, and parents being able to separate their own anxieties about their children's sexuality from their concern for their children's health.
I'm very grateful to all of you for being with us today. Katha Pollitt, author of Virginity or Death, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thanks so much for having me.
Linda Klepecki at the Focus on the Family in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Linda, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me too, Tom.
And Janet Gilsdorf, thanks for your work at the CDC, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. It's my pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.